The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for well over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the September 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. A theme this month has been Stories from the Open Road. This one is a very interesting story to me personally. I read about this last year, I think, in a brief article here. It is certainly an open road story and an important one in the history of the United States. The Green Book, Guide to North Carolina. For black families in the 1950s, the ribbons of asphalt that crisscross our state could be dangerous obstacle courses. Most hotels and other businesses denied African Americans basic services. Many travelers of color looked to a little-known guide, the Green Book, to find safety on the open road and community in our towns and cities. This is written by Mark. Early in Dr. Dudley E. Flood's distinguished career as a North Carolina educator, he and his wife Barbara were to embark on a two-day road trip from Hertford County to Missouri. The couple, both teachers, were headed to the National Education Association's annual convention held that summer in St. Louis. But the year was 1959, and Jim Crow laws were still in full effect. If you were black, the highways and back roads of North Carolina and the South at large could be menacing and potentially life-threatening. What's more, the vast majority of hotels and restaurants would not serve black guests. The owner of an SO gas station that Flood traded was suggested that the couple take along a copy of the Negro Traveler's Green Book, the travel guide that many African Americans consulted during the pre-civil rights years to avoid danger of embarrassment when looking for food, lodging, and other basic necessities. The air was already thick and muggy in Flood's tiny hometown of Winton on that late June morning when he cranked up his little six-cylinder Ford and headed north on Highway 13. He and Barbara had prepared for the trip as best they could, packing fruit and other snacks to nibble on while they drove. The interesting thing about the Green Book was that it helped you determine which routes you should take, remembers Flood, now 89, because some routes would not have provided you with access to places that would be accommodating. Using the guide, the Floods mapped their way north into Virginia, then west toward Kentucky. The couple stopped along the way to order meals from Tasty Freeze or Dairy Queen, two of the few restaurant chains that they knew would serve black customers through outside takeout windows. In Louisville, the Floods drove to Brown's Guest House, a little flea bag that they'd seen listed in the Green Book. It was a mess, but they stayed for that night. And the next morning, they awoke early and continued into lower Indiana, making time for a few detours for antiquing. The Floods were wiped out by the time they reached the town of Vincennes, and they decided to stop over again before driving to St. Louis the next day. But the Green Book had no listings for Vincennes. I wasn't worried about it, though, because the myth that I had grown up with was, "You're in the North now, you're going to be okay." Things are different here, Flood recalls. They saw a vacancy sign in a hotel and pulled into the lot. I walked up to the desk and asked the lady if we might be accommodated, and she said to me, very curtly, "I'm sorry, but we don't have anything." I said, excuse me, but I noticed your sign, and the light is still on that says you have vacancies. She said, well, that's a mistake. After some wrangling with the manager, the floods moved on, exhausted and demoralized. They finally arrived later that night in East St. Louis, where they found another hotel listed in the Green Book and stayed for the night before heading to the convention. Flood's first big trip using the Green Book was eye-opening. It wouldn't be his last. As a future administrator with the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, who many years later played a key role in desegregating the state's public schools, Flood would travel hundreds of miles each year on the back roads of North Carolina. He became intimately familiar with the Green Book and the places listed in it. And he wasn't the only one. From 1936, when Harlem postal worker Victor Green first introduced the Green Book, until 1966, when his wife quietly ceased publication 2 years after the Civil Rights Act rendered it less of a necessity, the little guidebook was an essential tool for black travelers. But in the last half century since then, memories have faded, people have died, and old Green Book travel stories like Flood's have been consigned to the footnotes of history. A funny thing happened in 2018. That year, director Peter Farrelly released his Oscar-winning movie Green Book, the true life tale of a black New York City classical and jazz pianist and his white driver who set out on a concert tour of the Deep South in 1962. Armed with a copy of the Green Book, the pair's inevitable brushes with racists along the way made for a story that piqued renewed interest in the guide. Suddenly, historians and regular folks alike began looking for old copies of the Green Book and searching for the places that were listed in it. At North Carolina State University, a group of students were ahead of the curve. Over the previous couple of years, they'd begun work on identifying Green Book sites in our state. Their research led to a $148,000 grant for the Green Book Project, which was to set up to document each of North Carolina's more than 300 locations, from the Mrs. S. Foster Tourist Home in Asheville to the Murphy Hotel in Wilmington. We wanted to determine the status of these sites, whether they're still standing or whether they were demolished, said Angela Thorpe, director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, which oversees the project. We wanted to understand where these sites were in terms of the geography of the state so that we could get a clear sense of what sites existed in what counties. Lisa R. Withers, a doctoral candidate in public history, managed the data gathering. She and the team compiled the addresses of businesses listed in the Green Book and drove to historic black neighborhoods across the state to talk with people who lived near the old sites. Of the 327 Green Book listings in North Carolina, the team has located 66 still standing buildings. A few of them, like Dove's Auto Service, just off South Queen Street in Kinston's historic African-American commercial district, are still in business. One of the more notable Green Book sites in North Carolina is the Magnolia House on Gorrell Street in Greensboro, a green-trimmed, two-story, 5,000-square-foot Victorian home. Built in 1889 and restored at least twice in the past 130 years. The Magnolia had fallen into disrepair by the 1980s and remained an eyesore until a Federal Express worker named Samuel Penn Pass drove by it one day in 1995 and saw a for sale sign in the front yard. He bought it and restored it to its Green Book era glory. The first thing that the children noticed when Sweet Daddy Grace pulled up in front of the Magnolia House and emerged from his shiny European convertible were his freakishly long fingernails. It was the early 1950s, and Reggie Hodges and his buddies had been playing kickball in a field across the street when the famous faith healer, the founder of the United House of Prayer for All People, arrived with great fanfare. The kids stopped their game and bolted over to the curb for a closer look. Daddy Grace stepped out of the car, and it was as if God himself had arrived in the segregated black neighborhood at the edge of downtown. People were amazed when they saw him surrounded by all of his entourage, Hodges remembers. But what really stood out to me were his fingernails. They were 2 or 3 inches long, and he wore this military-type suit. Hodges pauses. And that car, he continues with a muted gasp, I'd never seen anything like it in my life. It wasn't the first memorable display that Hodges, now 75, had witnessed in front of the Magnolia. His family lived around the corner on Martin Street, and he and his friends would pass by the big house almost every day on their way to the ball field. He says Jackie Robinson once arrived at the Magnolia during the Dodgers' trek back up to Brooklyn following spring training in Florida. Singer Nat King Cole stayed at the Magnolia while on a trip to nearby Sedalia to visit the Palmer Memorial Institute, a private school for black kids that today houses the Charlotte Hawkins Brown Museum. And jazz pioneer Louis Armstrong once scarfed down a plate of country ham drenched in syrup cooked up by Louise Gist, who owned the Magnolia along with her husband, Arthur. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the Magnolia was one of the hottest spots in Hodges' neighborhood. What I remember most was the quality of the cars that people drove up in, he says, because they were so different from other cars you'd see. They were red and shiny, and they were Cadillacs and convertibles. And I remember the hair, the processed hair. And I remember that the men who drove the cars wore black suits and caps, and they'd open the doors for these people to get in and out. Hodges had never seen black people treated like royalty, and it mesmerized him. I didn't know anything about the Green Book at the time, he says. I was just a kid. All I knew was that the Magnolia was the hotel where important black people could stay. Sifting through the first-hand memories of people like Hodges and Flood was a key part of Withers' research for the Green Brook Project. One of her goals was to get a sharper picture of who used the travel guide, why they used it, and who owned the North Carolina businesses listed in it. In the Magnolia's case, the Gists bought the house in 1949, a decade after the Green Book began publication, to convert into a multi-room hotel for black travelers. Soon, jazz musicians, writers, and other notable black Americans learned about the house and booked rooms there when passing through Greensboro for engagements. When you think about the Green Book narrative that's generally told, it often comes from more of a middle-class perspective. People who would have been able to own a car and stay in a hotel, Withers says. So it makes sense that when I was interviewing community members, some of them were like, I don't have anything to contribute to your project because my family didn't take vacations. As she explored the listings more scrupulously, Withers began to wonder why the Green Book included so many barber shops and hair salons, businesses that weren't necessarily geared to travel. From my 21st century perspective, I'm thinking that if I'm taking a trip, I'm going to have my hair done before I get on the road, not during the trip, she says. But what we have to remember is that for African Americans, beauty salons, particularly in the Jim Crow era, were not just about beauty. They were political and cultural hubs within black communities. People would come into towns and go to these places to connect with each other. So the Green Book could have been about more than just avoiding danger on the road or having a safe place to stay. It also told you where black people gathered. A tiny booklet, just 5 by 7 inches, small enough to stuff into your glove compartment or pocket. Early editions of the Green Book cost a quarter and included a note from the publisher that read in part, "We earnestly believe the Negro Motorist Green Book will mean as much, if not more, to us as the AAA means to the white race." To Thorpe of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, it means a glimpse into the secret inner workings of black social life from a time when African Americans experienced constant harassment by powerful members of the dominant white culture. So we also think of the Green Book as a resistance tool, she says. In many cases, it enabled a certain class of African American people to create spaces for black people to seek refuge in. And the folks behind these spaces were critical catalysts for pushing for civil rights and change in North Carolina in a really specific era of time, that felt volatile to many black people. It was an era whose ripples have extended well beyond 1966, the year the Green Book stopped publication. By 1970, a decade after Flood's first experience using the guide during his trip to St. Louis, he was traveling an average of 50 to 60,000 miles a year in North Carolina for the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. His mission? To complete the desegregation of our schools. Even then, I knew where I would be treated well and where I wouldn't, Flood says. If I wanted to go east from Raleigh, we didn't have 264 then, I had to go through about 8 or 9 little towns before I would get to Wilson, and I knew every one of them. I know which ones would like to have me stop and which ones wouldn't. Not that he would be refused service in hotels or restaurants. By the 70s, those businesses had long been required to serve black people. But you would visibly see the distinction of how you were served, Flood says. We understood that the more remote the place was, the less interaction there would be between and among the races, and the less clarity folks would have on how humans might be. We knew that. But Dr. Dudley E. Flood wasn't one to become enraged by such things. Like the researchers behind the Green Book Project today, Flood's presence out in the field was to help shine a light on the blind spot in people's lived experience. The job was to teach, he says, not to complain. It was to teach people, so that's what I did. And by about the mid-1970s, things got better. He pauses and then adds, not well, but better. We have a sidebar, the Green Book Tour. There's a picture here of two African-American men walking on the side of a road. One of them's carrying a suitcase. The other is carrying his jacket in one hand, maybe a little lunch pail, and then a grocery sack or something in the other hand. They both have wide-brimmed hats on. They have long-sleeved shirts and long pants. And they're trudging along the grass in this black-and-white photo. Migratory agricultural workers of the 1940s, like these men, walked the shoulder of North Carolina 27, would hitchhike north to follow the potato season. A copy of the Green Book, tucked into their luggage, could help find them welcoming places to stay at night. The Green Book Tour? In March, the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission launched the Green Book Project's traveling exhibition at the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro and the Haiti Heritage Center in Durham. Reggie Hodges and others participated in panel discussions with Lisa R. Withers to talk about their experiences. The exhibition will continue at various locations through 2021. This month, it travels to the Allegra West Brooks Regional Library near the historic West Charlotte High School, which played a major role in the integration of public schools in the 1970s. The Charlotte exhibit runs from September 8th to October 10th. At right are the other North Carolina dates, which are subject to change due to the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, visit aahc.nc.gov/green-book-project. Those spots very quickly are the North Carolina State Capitol, now through October 26th, Burke County Public Library, November 20th to December 18th, Charlotte Hawkins Brown Museum, December 11th to January 22nd, Magnolia House, January 29th to March 1st next year, Central Piedmont Community College next March, Tryon Place next March to May, Cape Fear Museum next July, Imperial Center for the Arts and Sciences next July and August, Museum of the Albemarle, September and October 2021, and finally Somerset Place, November 5th to November 17th, 2021. So, for now, North Carolina State Capitol would be the best place to catch it through October 26. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Give us a call if you have any comments or questions, 919-781-1973. And now, the Bamboo Princess. In Ashborough, a young explorer finds a peaceful escape in a castle built with imagination and towering stalks of native bamboo. Written by Todd Delaney. There's a young woman here walking through what looks like a forest. It's highly lit in the background, so the sky is completely white. And then we see light green leaves, and up close we see some bamboo shoots. And she has a walking stick, and it says, walking on soft and crunchy fallen oak leaves, six-year-old Una Delaney surveys her kingdom in Randolph County, where a stand of giant cane bamboo grows in her backyard. Overleaf is another picture of her in her backyard. It says Bamboo Rock, also known as the living room couch, allows Una to stand just a little bit taller than her usual 4 feet. But she's still dwarfed by the bamboo, which can grow to 25 feet. A mysterious world grows in our backyard. Dark and seemingly impenetrable, with a jagged green canopy that shakes forebodingly when the wind blows. In the slightest breeze, it whispers. But from within, there's a louder voice. Come on, Dad. Come see Bamboo Rock. My daughter, Una, is 6. And for the past several years, the bamboo forest in our backyard, a modest 50-foot-wide stance stretching between a pair of 100-foot-tall white oaks, has been her domain. At first, she was drawn to the piles of canes that I culled every winter. They were long and light. Una was small and mighty. She wielded them like a little ninja gladiator with pigtails. With apologies to Shakespeare, she was fierce. She was soon shimmying her way between the stalks to explore the strange place. And like the town crier for her little bamboo shire, she excitedly announced every discovery, every shoot, every stone, every caterpillar, ant, and spider. When she spotted a robin's nest with a sparkling strand of plastic woven into it, you would have thought she'd stumbled on the lost ark. We were going to explain that the streamers on her tricycle were the source of the sparkling bit of plastic, but it would have dulled the luster of her find. As she grew into a trailblazing kindergartner, she wore a path through her forest. This spring, my machete and I made sure the trail remained passable for Una and her guests, both real and imaginary. I took out pointy branches at eye height, and she identified shoots that would impede her tours. When she's not showing off to her friends the rooms that we carved out of her castle, she's playing make-believe in those same rooms, explaining to her dog, Seamus, where he needs to lie while she serves him tea. Naturally, her dutiful liege obliges. While Una goes about creating her own characters and legends, actual folklore surrounding bamboo is rich and global. In the Philippines, a popular creation myth holds that humankind was born from a stalk of bamboo. In China, shoots are said to grow where a grief-stricken child's tears once fell, which isn't beyond the realm of imagination. There are times when the frustrations of being 6 overwhelm Una, and the world is just too much, and she seeks refuge in the bamboo, finding solace in the cool and calm of the stalk. It's possible that our bamboo predated our house being built and may have even been growing there before our town existed. There are more than 1,600 types of bamboo worldwide, mostly in Asia, but one genus, Arundinaria, thrives in North Carolina, and it's the appropriately named Arundinaria gigantea, giant cane that grows in our backyard. I'd love to credit its presence between our oaks to the whims of Mother Nature. But based on the placement of several flowering shrubs within the grove, it looks like well-meaning landscapers back in the day strategically placed pots of bamboo here and there as a dramatic backdrop of vertical canes. Bless their hearts. Don't get me wrong, the bamboo creates a gorgeous screen at the back of our property. but it has the tendency to spread with a little regard for the best of landscaping intentions of boundaries. I'm not sure if our back door neighbors share our enthusiasm for what, to many, is a pernicious invader. Good fences make good neighbors. Bamboo does not. Ours isn't the only property where bamboo thrives, of course. It's easy to spot legitimate forests of bamboo tucked away in forgotten corners of lots throughout our Ashboro neighborhood and across the state, for that matter. One of Una's favorite spots to visit is the North Carolina Zoo with its acres of bamboo. Like other kids, she's captivated by the lions and polar bears and would love nothing more than to cuddle with the river otters and shrimps. But she seems to be most in her element on the path to the aviary, where 30-foot-tall stalks of black bamboo create a cathedral. Walking through that tunnel with walls of thick bamboo bowing overhead, she stretches out her arms, filling the void as best she can, soaking in the relative enormity of nature. Walking among the exhibits, Una is dwarfed by the yellow and golden varieties that grow even taller than the black bamboo. And then there's the 100-foot-tall timber bamboo by the Lemur exhibit that transports Una from the heart of North Carolina to the heart of Madagascar. Maybe she'll add botanist or landscaper or lumberjill to her what I'm going to be when I grow up list, which currently consists of ballerina and lifeguard and veterinarian. And why not? After all, she's Una, and this is her world. Well, in the last minute we have at the near the front of our state, there's a little section called The View from Here. And it's a double page spread of a photo. This is a very pretty photo. It's called Summer's Sunset Manteo. As the season comes to an end and beachgoers pack their bags to return home, calm settles over the North Carolina coast. Here on the Outer Banks, the creek that runs between Roanoke Island Festival Park and Manteo is quiet too, reflecting the sun as it dips below the horizon. One final farewell to summer. This is a dusk picture. We have the bow of a boat here. There is a young lady sitting there in shorts and a sleeves that are rolled up to her elbows, and she has long blonde hair down to the center of her back. She's looking down, it looks like a canal here, and she's looking at that sunset. The sun's gone, but its rays are reflected up into the clouds that have built up on the horizon above some homes that are right on the water. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call the studios, please, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.